You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Yeah, man.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader, and my friend Tom Nugent is here. Knives by Nuge, and I'm so psyched to talk to him. Great guy. But before we get to it, let's take care of a little business. Number one, I want to thank my friends at Broadback Ironworks, and they are the makers of an awesome grinder, a 2x72 grinder. I love this thing. I use it all the time. I got two of them. I am spoiled. And you should be spoiled too. And if you go to BroadbackIronworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you will get 10% off a discount code. And they're having a Black Friday sale from November 15th through the 30th. Knife Talk 10 doesn't count, but they're going to have a great sale the 15th through the 30th. So check out what's going on over Broadback Ironworks. Different grinders, you get different attachments, different packages. Definitely worth it. BroadbackIronworks.com. Many thanks to my friends over there. Next is my friends at EvenHeat. EvenHeat are the manufacturer of the finest heat treat ovens available. Go find your next oven at evenheat-kiln.com. Definitely check out their tap control. Definitely check out their solid state drive. Don't sleep on those. They're super easy to use. And if you just want to do the old turn and burn, the set it and forget it, they got that. So you just dial up to the temperature. Bingo, bango, bongo. You're all squared away. But the EvenHeat guys are really great in terms of working with knife makers, tool makers, hammer makers. They make the greatest kilns for some of the best guys who are hardening their stuff around. So go check out what's going on. evenheat-kiln.com. Next are my friends at Nordic Edge. That's at Nordic_Edge on Instagram, nordicedge.com.au. It's a great pro tool knife company in Australia for people who want to get into blacksmithing, bladesmithing, for knife making. They have materials. They have all the stuff you need to get started or resupply. They got the screw-on file guide that they made with Mertansu. Outstanding. They have a tang hole saw that's really great. They have other things that they've made, like beveling jigs and stuff like that. So if you're in Australia and you're looking for a little bit of something, go check out my friends over at nordicedge.com.au. And if you want to, if you're in the United States and you'll be like, I want to know what Mertansu is doing, go to knifekits.com and check out the big Mert file guide. It's a monster, total monster. Next is Lawrence Lake. Lawrence Lake, this guy is unbelievable. Maritime Knife Supply is unbelievable. All your belts, all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, everything you need to get started, resupplied. They're in Canada, but they ship with ease. I ordered something on Tuesday night. It arrived Friday morning. I'm in New York. He's in Canada. I don't know how he does it, but he does it. And it's the same price. The shipping was the same price. Everything was the same price. There was no fooling around. Definitely worth it. And if you're in Canada, he's the guy to go to. He's going to get everything that you thought you needed, that you do need, or you will need. Go to maritimeknifesupply.com, and he's got something special going on. This is the reason why he's great. Lawrence has a scholarship, and the application for the New England School of Metalwork, it's a scholarship that can be applied. You can apply for it until December 1st, so you got to hustle. It's the Maritime Knife Supply ABS Intro to Bladesmithing Scholarship, and it's open to people from 16 to 30 years old. Definitely go to, there's a link in the Maritime Knife Supply Instagram, but I'm sure if you went to the New England School of Metalwork, you can get that squared away. And for sure, you're talking about a guy who's into it. Lawrence Lake is definitely into it, and he's doing this for knife makers because he's a bladesmith too. I saw him forging. He knows what he's doing. I'm with you, maritimeknifesupply.com. Definitely check out what he's got. And if you're in Australia, if you're in Canada and you think, well, he doesn't have this, tell him. He'll get it. I'm telling you, he's a smart guy. So maritimeknifesupply.com. I want to thank my friends Sam and Jeff over at the Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise. They're makers of the Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise at trojanhorse.com, Trojan Horse Forge. Their vices are built in the heart of Texas, and they will take your handle finishing to a whole new level. You know, not only just your handle finishing scale, the handle, but your blade too. They have plates that bolt on. It holds your knife. Doesn't matter what kind of knife you have, an integral bolster, a hidden tang, full tang. You got complex curves. It will support and hold your knife comfortably, so you can hand sand it perfectly. Every one of my knives goes on that. The Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise twice, once to hand sand and the other to the handle. So if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you're going to get 10% off everything. 10% off the handle press attachment, which thing is sweet. The handle press attachment fits into your Trojan Horse Forge so you can glue up and hold your knife safely and straight and comfortably. And it is awesome. And their T4 Sentinel oil is dynamite stuff too. And if you wanted to be an affiliate, reach out to them, get a case, and then you can be an affiliate for them, make a couple extra bucks. So go to TrojanHorseForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off. And they have payment plans too. So check it out. Thank you to my boys over there, Trojan Horse Forge. Next is BakerForge.com. I just whipped out some copper mascus. Man, you can't make it. You can't make something so complex so easily like the stuff at Baker Forge and Tool. And I'll tell you what, I'm always impressed. Koi sends me some stuff every time. I've never seen delaminations. I've never seen problems. I've never been like, oh, the core's not in the middle. Oh, no, no, no. Stuff is awesome. The bronze my, tiger my, copper my, all that stuff. It's all visually stunning stuff. And it's easy to use. You can use your table. You can use your bandsaw to cut it. Not one of them shitty ones. You can't have one of them, you know, grandpa's old, you know, Black and Decker that we use for cutting plywood. That ain't going to do it. But you get yourself a portaband or a grinder. You could use a right angle grinder. Get yourself squared away. It's super easy to use. It's super duper easy to heat treat. It looks great. Finishes awesome. And if you use that gator piss, boy, you're going to make it look great. I love this gator piss. And it is their proprietary etchant. That stuff is awesome. And the funniest part is people like, you know, serious knife makers who charge serious dollar amounts also take themselves a little bit too seriously. And they say stuff like, well, I don't like gator piss, I don't like the name. But they have it. So that's the difference. You can talk the talk, you can walk the walk, but I've had some of the best knife makers in the game. They all make, oh, I don't like this stuff, and they have it. So if they have it and they don't like it, the name, that's on them. But trust me, they're using it. So get yourself some of that gator piss. And if you go to BakerForge.com, put in the promo code, FULLBLAST, you can get 10% off. And if you're in Europe, go to DIYEurope.eu, get yourself some of that gator piss, and you're going to be in business. You know what I'm saying? Many thanks to Koi. We're going to get him on sooner rather than later. He's busy. Watch him on Instagram. Go check out Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram. Definitely worth it. I want to thank my friends at Total Boat. We're mixing up some Total Boat right now. We're using their two-part epoxy. It's marine grade. They make marine grade stuff. They have they have adhesive, paints, primers, polishing compounds, but they also have two-part epoxy that is great stuff. If you're putting together some handle scales, you're slapping on a hidden tang knife, you need something with some good stuff, get yourself some of that Total Boat. And you go to totalboat.com/fullblast and you check out what they got going on. I just got a stack of stuff from my friends at GL Hansen & Sons. I got the Hoopla. The Hoopla might be my favorite of all of his G-Carta. It is really dynamite stuff. It is cross-cut. He makes these. I had some chefs from Stone Barns, the shop. Big name drop right there, ladies and germs. That's how you do a name drop. They were just in the shop, and they were looking at their stuff, and they were looking at the Hoopla, and I explained what it was. And I explained it. So, wow, this is like, you know, they make a loaf of fabrics and different colors, and they use heat, and they use pressure, and they make this giant loaf, and then they cut the cross cut of the loaf, and then they make these scales, and their stuff is dynamite. So he just sent me some. He sent me some of my favorite, which is Hoopla. Hoopla is my favorite. I use a lot of it. The Colorama by Mikey is really cool. The Pheasant, the Ripple Cut by Tuxini, Mahi Mahi Radio Room, Jakarta, Jakarta. The stuff's got such razzle-dazzle, and it really is easy to work with. I would highly suggest getting some of that, and you can get the variant of the Hoopla that I named Electric Fuzz. So go to jakarta.bigcartel.com. Get yourself some of that razzle-dazzle in your life. You know what I'm saying? And then last but not least, my boys at Tormek, they did it again. They're celebrating 50 years, congratulations, of being in business, and they made the Black T8 sharpening system. Their water-cooled sharpening systems have saved my life. They made me a better knife maker. They're really easy to use. You can use jigs, or you can go jigless, no problem with that. Go to Tormek.com, check out what they have, or you can go to Tormek_sharpening on IG. And the last but not least, I want to say this. This is cross-promotion, ladies and germs. This is coming out on Friday, Saturday the 18th. Knife Talk is doing a live event. We are hosting the Damascus Steel Chef Knife Invitational. And if you go to damascussteel.se, you can register free. And there's going to be tons of knife makers. And you can virtually interact with the show. You can listen to Knife Talk. You can also meet other knife makers. I know Fingal Ferguson is going to be there and a lot of knife makers that you know. So go to damascussteel.se, register for free. They're not asking for anything. And it's a really awesome event. You can interact with these guys. You can watch Knife Talk, and it's definitely worth it. So check out that this coming Saturday, I think the 18th, for sure, 100%. Next is my guest. Thomas Nugent is a really interesting character. I had a really good time meeting him at Maker Camp. He's got an awesome story. He's a hard working guy. I'm really glad he's here. Tom, how the hell are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. I really appreciate you having me on here too.
You're a fascinating guy, and I'll tell you why. I've been watching you from the beginning, and it is one of the hardest things. I feel very guilty about a lot of things. A lot of things I feel guilty on is I feel like Knife Talk has given people the feelings that it is easy to make money making knives. And you get a lot of guys who will stop their job or change jobs and become knife makers. And a lot of guys I talked to, Noah Vachon, he says there's a lot of people selling their equipment, you know, after a couple months and stuff like that. I give you a lot of credit because you are one of the hardest working young buck knife makers in the game right now. And it is a real honor to talk to you because you got a lot of hustle.
Thanks, man. It's a lot of drive. And I think a lot of people at times have like a misconception going into it that all you have to do is just make more knives than you make money. And there's a whole lot more that goes into running a business, especially something of like selling hard goods like knives where there really isn't that much of a markup as is.
Yeah. Well, it's weird because, you know, there's this strange delineation. By the way, Tom has a company called Knives by Nuge. I'm going to have it linked in the show notes, and we're going to go all about it. The interesting thing is there's this total separation between this concept between art and craft. But also, they don't throw in business. Like, there's art, there's craft, and then there's business. It's almost three different things. And there's this like feeling as though you're told that you can learn how to do something, you enjoy doing it, and then all of a sudden the money just starts rolling in. And I feel guilty that Knife Talk has made a lot of people think like, oh, this is like the gold. This is like the gold rush, and everybody just get their shovels and find the nearest stream and start panning for gold.
Yeah, there's a lot more that goes into it than just like, you know, like we said, like it's not as easy as just making the knives. You also have to sell them. You also have to market them. There's also this little thing called like taxes you got to worry about too. Right. And it's like there's so many people just worry about the end product and not so much of the actually how to sell it, which is why I love the conversation you had with Brian House last week, because he's a guy that I look up to a lot too, because he says it all the time. Like, you need to spend just as much time like selling the product as you do making it. And I think at times makers get so obsessed with the process of making instead of also the process of selling and, you know, trying to pay your mortgage, because that's kind of important too.
Yeah. Well, I listened to Arnold Schwarzenegger was on Howard Stern a couple weeks ago. I think he's promoting a book, a self-help book, which is like everyone's just like, yeah, that's just what I need, a fucking self-help book from Arnold Schwarzenegger. And one of the interesting things he said was the difference between him and a lot of actors back in the, you know, the 80s was most of these actors would not promote the movies. And they wouldn't go out of their way to try to get people to go to the movies. And he says one of the things that I learned, I guess when he came to the United States, he started doing like a, I guess they were doing a, he started a roofing company, and all of his, all the guys in the roofing company were all, they were all bodybuilders. Sorry, there's a leaf blower going in the background. The guys are blowing leaves. But he started this body, this bodybuilding company filled with, I mean, a roofing company filled with bodybuilders. And what happened was he started to realize that he needed to learn business and marketing in order for things to work. So when he started doing movies, he said, well, I'm going to go on these shows and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure the money, that the movie does well. If the movie does well, then I'll do well. And he really was one of the best at selling a movie. And the interesting thing was he said a lot of these artist types or craftsmen or whatever, they're, or actors in his regard, he's unwilling to put in the work that it takes in order to sell the product that they're selling. Like, he found like these guys were just like too good to do it.
Well, I noticed a lot of that even from doing local shows and stuff like that, like maker shows, other events like that, where we're selling. Like, I'm always standing behind the table. I'm personable. I'm looking people in the eyes, talking to them. And then a lot of other people, they're just like hiding in the corner of the booth and just expecting their work to sell itself. And sure, I'm sure it can at times, but like, how much more could you move and sell if you were actually like showing your passion and sharing it with them? Because then it gets them excited about all of it too. And even with, like, you know, Arnold built such a hype around his movies. They weren't going to see the new like Commando movie. They're going to see the new Arnold movie because that's how he was promoting it.
That's, well, I mean, that was a big takeaway. And I think that there, I think a lot of it came from the fact that I know a lot of knife makers who what they say to young knife makers is, don't make what people want, make what you want, and the work should sell itself. And I hear that. I used to hear that a lot from knife makers who say, the work should sell itself. You shouldn't have to do all this. You shouldn't have to do all this. But at the same time, there's a lot of hope going around. And one of the things is I know so many of these guys, so many artists in general, not just knife makers, but artists in general, who are so goddamn talented. And they're filled with talent, but they don't have the drive. And I started to think about you a lot, and I thought about, you know, your rise and the things that you do. And your Instagram is always really good, and every morning you're doing something and you're just looking at the camera in the eye. And I wonder if you take drive is almost more important than talent, because you can be creative. People are creative. I had creative ideas when I was younger, but if I don't execute them, then what the fucking doesn't even matter, you know?
Well, you just need the persistence too with a lot of these things, because it's, I mean, a lot of guys think that you're just going to make a couple reels and then just like blow up and go viral. But like, I almost gave up on the whole trying to go viral, and I'd rather just keep that consistent, steady push and growth going with things. And then also too, like while doing that, like keeping in touch with your customers and really interacting with them. And I rather have that than like a big blow up. Because even like I was talking with my buddy, and also he's been helping me out with all the business, Nick at Black Flag Survival. I'm like, I want to just keep a steady push, because I'm almost afraid if things get too big, you know, can you even keep up with the demand at that point? Which, like, right now, like, it's just me working. So you almost don't want to get too big too fast and then have it all collapse down on you.
I really truly believe in my heart that slow and steady wins the race, and just being consistent is the most important thing. And you don't need to see monumental growth. You just need to see growth.
No,
I think that number one, I think experience is underrated. I say that till the day I die. I meet, just talking to, I had these chefs in who came in, and we were talking about serrated knives. And with a chef, he's an awesome chef. And he was saying to me, he's like, yeah, I tried sharpening a serrated knife and I ruined it. And he says, I was in my kitchen in my house. I was using a Dremel. And I immediately knew what happened. And I said, I bet I know what happened. And he says, I said, I think that you were holding the Dremel and the Dremel just ran away on top of the knife. You just start running away. Because that's what happens with the Dremel. Yeah. If you're not super steady and you have like a, your elbows are anchored down, you're like holding it and then you're moving it in one direction, it just starts, it touches down and it's like rolls right off. He's like, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And I was like, yeah, well, I mean, you know, I've fucking done that a million times with the Dremel, like experience is underrated. And I said, if you would take that Dremel next time and then you clamp it to a table and then you kind of bump the knife against the Dremel bit, if it's clamped well, that might make things easier for you. And it was just like, he just looked at me and I was just like, dude, you're an awesome chef. You're not a fabricator. You just, you know, and it's not your fault. It's just, experience is underrated. And it's impossible to be good right out of the bat with everything. And there's this total expectation that everyone's going to be good right off the bat.
Well, no, it takes a whole lot of screwing up, and at least that's what I've learned from myself, even with, like, you know, from making the knives or even which model is going to be big. Because there's, like, I've got a pile of knives, like, blanks that just sit in my basement because, you know, I thought they were going to be good. I mean, they're great knives, but, like, the market didn't really pick up on them. And it's like, you know, I could kick my feet and just say, well, how great of a knife it is, but, you know, or I could move on to something that people actually want. And, you know, kind of lick your wounds and move on, because everything is just about, like, trying things out and figuring it out and getting those experiences and then, you know, hopefully having enough coin left in your pocket afterwards to keep moving on.
I have a theory that I've been thinking about in regards to you, in regards to what you just said, but I want to bring it back a little bit. How did you start in knife making?
So it started with actually a buddy that I trained jiu-jitsu with. It was just one of those things. He was all about watching Walter Soro's videos.
Right.
And he was just showing me that and showing what he wants to make. And he's like, you're pretty handy. You could probably do something like that. I'm like, yeah, I probably could, but do I want to? And he's like, I don't know, come on. He bought a couple things, bought the classic Harbor Freight, like 1x30 afterwards, and, like, you know, just started running with it. And then, you know, I kept doing it. He had twins, so the twins kind of got in the way of the hobbies. And I just kept running with it. And I would definitely say, like, I came up through Knife Talk, like, from online digital platforms of how to, you know, learn these things. Because I have zero training experience in using really any kind of power tools.
Really?
I mean, even for my whole career, like, before that I was doing this full time, I was in law enforcement. And everything with that was trying to get into law enforcement. Even going to college was all based for that. Like, that was the goal to get onto. And not really doing that much work with my hands. I mean, I was always an outdoorsman, so that's different. But, like, not with, like, running power tools and stuff. That was all just stuff I absorbed off, like, online forums, researching everything, podcasts, and a lot of them.
Wow. When you were young, I know that you did a lot of hunting and fishing and stuff like that. Did a parent bring you involved, make you involved with that, or?
No, it was really actually the Boy Scouts. My parents are freaking, it's actually funny. My dad is so useless with his hands. It's funny because he's a metallurgical engineer, and I'm pretty sure the only reason why he was so good at his job is because he went into the refineries after a fault happened, and he was looking for where somebody half-assed something. I'm like, oh, that's why you're so good at your job, because you know what you would have half-assed on this.
Well, so, what did he actually do? I don't understand what he did.
He would be inspecting pipes and welds and failures and stuff like that on the oil rigs and everything. So wow. He was all over the place. But he would be looking for where somebody got lazy, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's why you're good at your job. But yeah, he had never really trained me up on anything. It was a lot of the Boy Scouts that really got me into the outdoors.
So was he flying all over the place to inspect welds and stuff like that?
Yeah, he was flying all over the place, a lot in the Middle East. He was actually on one of those lists for a while, which always got him to the front of the line. But
what do you mean, what list? Like a no-fly list?
He wasn't on the no-fly list, but he was definitely on the extra pat-down list for a while.
Oh, really?
Because of a lot of the countries he had to travel to.
Oh, yeah, I bet. So,
and they were like, oh, you're off doing an awful lot of flights over there, and you only got one briefcase on you, and they, you know. And he's like, look at me. He's like, I'm old, fat Irish guy. What do you think I'm doing over here? It's like, I'm not going to be causing any problems for you guys. But he didn't care because he got to the front of the line every time.
Wow. So he would go and just go on to the – would he sleep on the oil rigs?
Yeah, so he would go there, stay there for a couple weeks, and that was like towards later on in his career. For a while, he grew up working for ConocoPhillips and Phillips 66 or whatever it was. It's changed name like 80 times. He's, you know, it was one of those jobs that he worked his whole entire life there, and then started doing a little more freelance work where he would travel all over the place.
And how did they get you to the oil rig?
I have no idea. That was all. I think they would either take him out on a boat or they fly him out there a couple times on helicopters. And, you know, he would have to do all that work. And a lot of times, too, it was land-based as well in the certain countries where it wasn't always on oil rig. But it just depends on where the client had to get him to. He definitely had some interesting stories, some of which I didn't always believe.
Was he independent, an independent inspector, or was he had to work for a company that would just send him all over the place?
So originally he started working for like ConocoPhillips, and that's who he was always working for, like the oil refineries in New Jersey. They actually, you know, back in the day, these companies actually went and paid for you to go to school. He got plucked up right out of high school. They're like, hey, do you want to be an engineer? And he's like, no. He's like, well, what if we pay for you to go to college and be an engineer for us? He's like, well, okay, sure.
Wow.
And yeah, crazy, right? And so then he worked for them for about 20 plus years, and then he started doing his own freelance work.
Wow. So when he would, what was the longest he would be away for?
A couple months at a time.
Whoa, that's got to be tough.
Well, I mean, I was a little bit older at that point, and I mean, yeah, we were all kind of like taking care of ourselves at that point, so it didn't really matter too much. I think he enjoyed the time away from all the madness at the house because we had four boys in our house, so it was a riot. My mom tried for one daughter with the last one, then got blessed with another boy, so it was a ruckus.
She must have been like, oh God, he's going to go inspect those welds, and I got to deal with these kids.
Yeah, there's a reason why every dog in the house was always a female. She needed at least some kind of female in the house because it was just four guys like me just running all over the place causing mayhem.
So what got you into the Boy Scouts?
So my older brother did it for a while, and I've always was like, it just like, I don't know, you know, like one of those weird things where you just start to click with stuff and you just really start to notice that this is like something I want to do. And two, it like my dad, you know, he's a great guy, but he wasn't always the best role model per se.
Okay.
And going there, it actually gave me like a really good, like positive male role models to look up to. Even like where my business sense comes from, our scout leader for the longest time, he worked for IBM, and he would be teaching us how to run the scout troop like a business and give it us the accountability. I mean, even the entire troop itself, it was always scout run where we would come up with all the ideas. We'd plan all the trips. Obviously like booking stuff and everything was left to the adults, and they would also listen into our planning. And, you know, every now and then be like, oh, we should do a paintball trip. And then you just hear across the room saying no. And I'm like, okay, scratch that.
But well, that's fair.
Everything was like scout run, which was nice because then you actually got to like, you know, have that little accountability. And I think that's also what helped me out in the future, because one thing that I always remember from him is he would talk about like with just the running a business or running a troop or everything else. There's the me picture, there's the us picture, and then there's the big picture. And he's like, everybody can see the me. Only a couple of people could see the group picture, and then only a select few can see the big picture. And like, it's those kind of lessons that I still carry with me now.
Huh. Well, I would imagine that it's very rewarding when an adult, and probably even more rewarding when it is not your parent, is giving you responsibilities. So when a lot of kids are together and you become friends and stuff like that, and then they start to, you bond, but then these adults are giving you responsibilities that they're not your parents, and there's not really favoritism, that's very rewarding.
And it's like, it's just enough room that you could go and you can make your own mistakes, because that's very important too, is let the kids make the mistakes and learn from them, but not enough that you're going to like end up with like, you know, missing limbs and stuff like that.
Right. So how did you get involved with hunting? Did Boy Scouts do hunting?
No, that was really what got me into camping and everything and being the outdoors. It was really... Okay. Going and working at different places, you know, just college jobs. I ended up getting a job at like a Dick's Sporting Goods, just some like bullshit job for beer money and everything. Right. And then when I was working there, I started hanging out with guys who did a whole lot more hunting and fishing. And then it just, you know, just spiraled into that where we were like, you know, buying new gear, trying things out. And I made a lot of good friends that taught me a lot, because I didn't really have any experience with all of that. So they kind of took me under their wing.
And then what made you want to go into law enforcement? Because that's kind of like a big departure from Dick's.
Well, yeah, dicks wasn't the end goal career.
I mean, that's not like, I don't see that. I see like there might be a missing step between dicks and law enforcement.
Yeah, like I said, beer money during college. But actually, when I was like 16, I became an EMT. And wow. So I was working EMS for a long time, volunteer. And I did that all the way up through college. And then I kind of like stopped because I got a job doing the same exact thing where I got paid instead of volunteering. So I was like, all right, I'm kind of done with this. But yeah, I was working on the ambulance corps for a long time. And I would always see the cops there. And I was like, you know, I already like doing this. I like, you know, this whole environment. You know, they're sure the adrenaline part, but also times like just helping people out, because those are some of the stories and like memories that I always keep with me. And I'm like, oh, I can get a job doing this. That sounds pretty cool.
Do you think that? All right. So basically, it all comes from the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, essentially.
I mean that the whole idea behind Boy Scouts is being helpful. Ultimately, it's being organized and being helpful. I would imagine at 16. So you were an EMT riding on ambulances?
Yeah.
What was the first ambulance call like? Were you terrified?
Nervous as shit.
I bet. Tell me about it.
It was, but it's like a lot of them, the nerves kind of got kicked away pretty fast. Cause I mean, there was like one call where I was probably just been doing it for about like 6 months, because most of the time, it was suburban New Jersey. It wasn't anything too crazy.
Right. And heart attacks. And
yeah. And even those, though, are like, you know, a lot of times it was like taking the person from the nursing home to the hospital. It's like, wasn't that crazy.
Yeah.
But like, there was one where it's like, and things got a little bit easier after this one. But there was a guy, he was having a heart attack. He was an older gentleman. And like, you know, we're doing CPR and everything. And all of a sudden, I just hear someone out of the corner of the room just go like, "Hey, Nuge." And I'm like, "What?" And I kind of look and turn, and it's my buddy's mom. And I'm like, "What?" It just like made you like stop.
Wow.
And luckily, the guy who was the crew chief, he was a very rough and gruff kind of guy. He was the man. He was just the right guy for the position, too. And he kind of, you know, gave me the snap the fuck out of it. And yeah. I was like, oh,
don't talk to her.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's like, we still got a job to do.
Unless you're going to give her mouth to mouth, don't talk to her.
Oh, I don't know, with her maybe. But sorry, I don't think Halperin's listening to this. He won't hear me talk about his mom.
Don't worry about that.
The worst part, though, is like, you know, is this guy's, it was my buddy's grandpa that we were working on. And then the next day I had to like sit next to him in bio class, and that was not fun.
How did they let you be EMT at 16?
I don't know. They need numbers.
Are you kidding me?
No, I mean, at that point too, like even like with me working like in Old Tappan, that's where my previous job was. They had a lot of young people working on the crew, and you know, they all have those moments like that too, where it's like, you learn fast that this is sometimes you can take your time, and sometimes you need to really go fast.
Hmm. So, I can only imagine that the EMT work that you did really made getting into law enforcement a little bit. I mean, I'm imagining. I would imagine that it made the transition a little bit easier.
Yeah, it definitely solidified it. And also, I kind of had like a baseline for being able to do these kind of things a little bit easier. And like, you know, it's just rapidly processing thoughts and trying to work fast.
So you went to college and then you applied to be in law enforcement in New Jersey?
Yeah. So I went, and at the time, because right now it's a little bit easier to get on as a cop than it was when I was trying to get on. I actually had to put myself through the police academy, and you had to apply for that. So I had to apply and get in and, you know, rank against a bunch of other people to get into the academy, which then I had to pay for. And then, so I did that for about 7 months without a paycheck. So Sally Mae was not happy about that one, because they were not getting their checks. But then after that, I got hired down in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, which is sort of like by Essex County, like Newark and East Orange and stuff like that.
Okay.
So that was a nice area. And it was kind of good to start there, because it was very diverse, because the town itself was, you know, very suburban, but then surrounded by very urban. So you got a little taste of everything, which was fun.
Did you enjoy law enforcement?
I enjoyed the work. I did not enjoy everything else with it.
I bet.
There was, you know, you can imagine 16-year-old me being like, oh, this is what I should do. This looks great. And then not seeing all the stuff behind it.
Right.
Like the bureaucracy, the paperwork, the stuff that makes absolutely no sense. And there's, as you can imagine, working for the government, there's a whole lot of that going on.
Hmm. I can't imagine. I have no idea. I just know what my wife works in a hospital, and I know what she deals with. And I just, and I guess I have this overwhelming feeling of it's never going to stop. I had this when I was in the restaurant game. I was the general manager of a restaurant, and my nightmares were I was tied down on a beach, and the waves just kept crashing over me. But the waves were the customers. And then all of a sudden it went for the door was open and just waves of customer, and there's never any reprieve. There's never any stopping. There's never any. And it was like I was overwhelmed by the humanity, frankly. So I can only imagine that she goes through the same thing. I can only imagine with you going, being an EMT and then getting into law enforcement, that, and you're thrown into these moments of people. I know people at their worst. You have to be at you have to be your best against people who are on their worst. And I just you know, I commend you for, you know, being around to do it.
Well, that was always one of the toughest things to deal with, because as you can imagine, you can see a lot of stuff that really it really gets you going, and you really have to pump the brakes. And you also need good people to look out for you, because sometimes, like, you know, there's days where you need to, like, tell somebody else, even if they're senior, like, hey, you need to walk out of the room, because we could all tell that you're getting heated, and you need to, like, look out for each other and stuff like that. Because, I mean, I could think of countless times where, like, you know, there are situations and things you would see where it's just like, where was the humanity when that person was acting the way they did?
Right.
And, you know, you would want to deal out your own justice, but they're like, nope, reel it back, because, you know, everything. And it's like, it's tough because it's human nature to see something like that and want to help somebody out. And then two, it's just like, it gets you on all your emotions. And you throw in it being like 3 a.m, you're exhausted, you're on your 8th cup of coffee.
Oh, and God.
I do not miss night shifts one bit.
Tell me about your first night shift. When they told you you're doing it, do you get a choice of whether you do a night shift or not, or they tell you you're going to do a tour of night shifts?
So it depends on the department. And like my previous one, we switched every 2 weeks, which was just, it was terrible, because you would do 2 weeks of day shift and then 2 weeks of night shifts.
How do you switch back and forth?
You don't. You just don't. Laura, my girlfriend, would tell me, like, on day 3 of a night shift in a row, I just, like, would look green in the face by the time I get back, because your body and your circadian rhythm is just so thrown off. And I think, too, for people that work in, like, offices or hospitals and everything, they have at least light. And for me, I'm in the dark all night long by myself. So like your body is saying, all right, it's time to go to bed. And then here you are having another like monster energy blowing up your heart.
Oh my God. What's a tour?
Like a 12 hour shift.
Oh, okay. So how many days a week would you work on?
It would depend on the week. Some weeks would be like 5 and then others were 2. So that wasn't that bad of a schedule, but, doing that job though, you don't know what days are anymore.
Right.
Like people are like, oh, it's Friday. I'm like, what? It's like, you know, for me, it's my Monday because I'm just starting my weekend shift. So like you kind of just, you know, everything just got blended into one big blur.
I have friends who are in law enforcement here in my town, and I just like, I love talking with them because sometimes they're just dead. One friend of mine, he's in a canine guy, and he sent me a message at like 3 o'clock in the morning. He says, are you at the shop? And I went, no, of course I'm not at the shop. He's like, well, I'm not too far from your shop. I thought I'd stop by. I'm like, dude, I'm not, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not awake. I'm asleep.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
A bunch of buddies that were always night owls. They knew if they wanted to call and bullshit with somebody that I'd probably be awake on my phone. And now I'm in bed by like 9:30 at night or falling asleep on the couch. And I love it.
What made you decide? So at what point did you start the knife making? You were still in law enforcement.
I think it was like around 2019. I wasn't really making knives. I was more like making shivs. That's kind of what they looked like when they were all done. So they weren't as good looking. But that was around 2019. They really started seriously picking up around, I would say, like 2021. is when things really got serious about it. And I was like, all right, maybe this actually can turn into a business. And just the way like the career was going and with, you know, my aspects on it and everything, it was like we were getting more and more responsibilities and our pay was actually going down,
right,
which is not normally how jobs are supposed to work.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. I hear that shit all the time.
And you're like, you know, and here I am like making just as much money working in my garage. So I'm like, what am I doing here? And then I started crunching the numbers, looking at what I would actually need to get by and what I would be happy with. And I'm like, I don't really need that much. I've already got everything kind of like set up. And I'm like, you know, then really came like 2021, it started getting serious. And then just this past January, I finally, you know, put in my papers. I was like, I'm done with this.
And how does it feel? Was it nervous? Were you nervous? I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, government jobs, it's a paycheck and you have this ability to, and I would imagine for you, I'm not saying it's easy, but you, since you were 16, you were doing the same, I don't know how old you are. I'm imagining you're early 20, mid 20s or something like that. I would imagine that you had a real, like almost like a callus to the work. Like you'd already, the blister was broken and now you're used to this kind of dealing with the public and in these situations. It must have been a very hard transition going from these jobs, I mean, since you were 16, to saying, okay, now I'm going to be making all this stuff out of my garage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm nervous every day about all of this because, like, it's, I mean, you're running your own business. Nothing is guaranteed. At least there, you knew you had a paycheck every 2 weeks and benefits, which was nice. But even with that, though, like, how things are going, my neighbor, he's a paramedic and he also works for a lot of the Marshall Task Force and do a lot of, like, warrant hits and everything. And he just took his use of force and lady even said, like, pretty much, like, if you have to use any kind of force, like, get ready for litigation. Like,
wait, you have to back up. What does that mean?
What, use of force?
Yeah.
Like, if you have to go hands-on with somebody, fight somebody, discharge your weapon or something like that. And this was a lady from the AG's office, which pretty much was saying the attorney general.
Yeah.
Was pretty much along the lines of, like, get ready for litigation because you're now guilty until proven innocent in this career, at least in this state. And so it's like, and then we would look around, we're like, so is this job really even that secure anymore?
Right.
Because like, if you have to defend yourself or to defend somebody else, or even at sometimes like do the job that you were hired to do, and now you're going to have to fight for your innocence. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's a little backwards.
But that's also in medical too, because like, you know, I remember talking to my wife and she says, my biggest fear is I'll have to like resuscitate someone out, you know, in the street. And if something happens, I can be sued.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of instances of like, you know, even people in hospital where people in medical in hospitals doing their job and something doesn't go right. And all of a sudden they're named in a lawsuit. And the hospital may or may not back you up. It's just like you wonder, you're just like, you put all this time, you put all this energy, you put all this education, you put all this stress. I'm sure you've lost years of your life of stress. And then all of a sudden, when it comes down to it, it's just like, I got only me to work, I got only me to support, you know, or me to who will support myself.
Yeah, people have this idea of security that I don't think is really there. And I mean, because everybody thinks they're like guaranteed like this job and this pension, or even if it's like a normal career that you're working, everybody thinks that everything's like going to just go down the plan and then you're going to hit 55, you're going to retire, you're going to spend half your time in freaking Florida at the villages doing God knows what. And that's not always the case.
Don't gloss over the villages.
Oh God. It's a,
don't gloss over the villages, guys, ladies and gentlemen, you're gonna have to listen to an old episode. The villages is, I guess, is the,
my parents got a place down there now and I'm kind of concerned.
It's the, apparently the villages is one of the, and you know, obviously I don't know about anything, but I read, and I had it on, when I had Ben Snur on, we were talking about weird stories. I guess it's like this, the STD capital of Florida. This is the villages. It's these old people all bumping uglies.
Nothing else to do but drink and bump uglies, I guess.
Yeah.
And play golf. So
God bless you. You turn 50 and you head right down to the villages. You know what you're doing.
You know about the loofahs, right?
No. You mean the loofahs, the things you scratch your back with in the shower?
Yeah, sure. But so they have a code system down there.
Go ahead.
And I just found out about this from my parents when we first went there. Just and
the new so, parents. Go
and ahead. You could God, yeah, don't make me think those thoughts.
no problem.
But so there's a chart you could look up online, and it's they have 6 different color variations of the loofahs that you put on top of your golf cart. And the loofah is like the sign that you're a swinger, but the different colors are different levels of what type of swinger you are.
Oh my god.
Where like I think like teal is like, hey, go easy on me, I'm just starting to get into this. And then black is like, let's get weird. And then there's one guy, we were stopping at a Publix, and God bless his heart, he was in one of those electric wheelchairs with his classic Vietnam vet hat on.
Yeah.
And he had all 6 loofahs on his wheelchair.
You're getting busy.
Hey, God bless.
Vets are entitled, aren't they? Aren't they entitled to have a little fun in their life?
Have a good life, especially at the end of it like that. But I'm like, God damn, this man is getting down.
I don't know.
Or not. Who knows?
Maybe he's getting down. Who knows?
He was trying to. At least he had every loofah saying, whatever you are, bring it on.
So, I mean, I would imagine, I remember when you posted and said that you just put your papers in and you're now full time. And that was really a cool moment because it was really like, I was just like applauding you from where I was being like, God damn, that is awesome. I remember when you wrote that I just quit my job and I'm a full-time knife maker. And it was like, it's scary. And at the same time, I one of the things about your knives, they're very bushcraft oriented, outdoors oriented. And where did you come up with your signature style?
I have no idea. Right. So it's, I think too, it's like just from a lot of use and a lot of, I think too, some people try to design a knife that's cool instead of designing a knife used for a task. And a lot of my knives are all like task oriented. Like, what would I be using this for? Why am I making this knife? And there's certain models that I do a lot where it's just like, they're kind of like a universal fit, like a kind of dual, which like it starts, some of them, like the Wicked is probably, I mean, I joke around that I'm Wickets by Nuge at this point because that seems to all I make. But it's a universal knife where it was originally meant for outdoorsmen, fishermen, hunters and stuff. And then like the EDC community picked it up, which like I'm not going to say no to that.
Right.
But I definitely didn't design it to be an EDC knife. And then even other knives, they just, because like you're designing it, the tool, and you're focusing on the tool and tasks it's for, it's then going to carry over into other tasks.
Do you think when you design these, you had a little bit of, because I mean, I know I have a few friends in law enforcement and then they want specific knives. And I wonder if you, any of your law enforcement experience in terms of like, I know what you guys have to carry the kitchen sink around with you every day. Did you ever think about how a person carries stuff as a police officer, law enforcement? Do you think about like those days just like, I didn't need this, or that was too big, or that's out of the way? Or because one of the things about your knives is a lot of them, you make a XL and you make a small. And when I was looking at some of the sizing, I was just like, that's a 2-inch blade. That is tiny. And all I could think of is he obviously understands about carrying stuff.
Well, with even law enforcement specifically, I made 2 different lines that are similar to each other but different. And it's the same kind of basis where like I have like a smaller and a bigger one. One of them just happens to have like those karambit rings on it, but it's not for like the Doug Micarta kind of crazy stuff. It's
right.
I designed it with a guy I went to the academy with who actually he got shot in the head. He's still here. But the guy was on top of his hips, so he couldn't access his firearm. And he was on the bottom of him, and the guy had his, his firearm right in his waistband over his groin. So he ended up taking a round to the head, and what he wanted as a design was something that could be worn very tight to a plate carrier or his vest or a belt or something like that, where somebody's not going to have access to it easily, but just to create distance. But at the same time, he wanted a knife that wasn't like just a knife fighting tool because he's also on the job. I mean, the first day he used it, he actually used it on a guy in the street who was having a heart attack in the winter in Jersey City. So he had like every single layer on possible, and he just used it to take off the clothes, like a zipper, and then get the pads on his chest. So like I wanted to make something that was carryable, defensive, but also could actually be used for all the other ridiculous tasks that you're using your knife for on the daily basis.
Hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I made another one off of that because I had guys on like SWAT teams and stuff who wanted just a bigger knife because they're most of the time wearing gloves. So, and they didn't want the little ring to put their hand in, and they wanted something to fill up the hand a bit more. And I'm like, so I had to design two around different carries where like the guys on the teams and everything, they're wearing the big like battle belt and everything else. And they're not doing like field interviews like I was doing where that knife could be hanging out in their belt and just out there easy to grab. Sure. Cause they're not getting up close and personal with people.
Right.
Where me, where I was like doing field interviews and stops with people, I wanted that thing where it's accessible to me, but not.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Everybody else around me.
Hmm. So I'm convinced. I think I love talking to knife makers because I'm convinced, you know, because we talk about whether or not something's original or something's where things come from. And I always think that everything comes from people's past. Everything comes from something that they remember or something that they would use or need in general. And so I always, you know, the neck knives you do and the wickets and those, we got to talk about your fishing knives. I've been trying to pull, I want to pull the trigger on some, one of them at some point soon, but I feel as though that there's definitely like, you're someone who didn't just learn how to do this by watching a Walter Sorrell's video. You have like real world experience in terms of, you know, using knives, either bushcraft or hunting or fishing or even law enforcement.
Well, I think that's like, you know, you talk a lot about experience, and that's what it really goes behind all of it is all this experience from actually doing those kind of things. I don't have the manufacturing or metalworking or any of that kind of experience, but I have the use of the tool. So you almost know what you want and what you want to see. And then now I had to figure out the whole putting that actually, you know, pen to paper and making that actually happen.
Well, I wonder how hard that was to make the transition of never working with tools before to, because you do volume. You do much more volume than someone who's, I mean, you've only been doing it for a couple of years. You have made the decision to kind of do more volume. I know you work with New Jersey Steel Baron. Those guys are great. I rattled Jerry's cage on Friday. He's just listening. That's a little insider. Some of the people are going to know and some people aren't going to know. I joyfully rattled his cage on Friday. So I know you're very involved with those guys and the water jet services and stuff like that. So what made you come to the conclusion that I'm going to invest in the company by doing, you know, taking a lot of the labor out by doing volume?
Well, it's, you really just look at the numbers, and I've been spending a whole lot of time recently looking at my time. I've been timing myself for my processes. I know how much time goes into each model and how long, like grinds, assembly, handle material. And then it's like, you really start looking at margins and you're like, you know, you have to figure out where you could actually make your money. Because some of the more intricate stuff that I do, like recently I did those crazy Cerakote ones with the Hawaiian print on the knife and everything.
Love them.
Those were fun. But I got hosed on my margins because things were just expensive. Right. I mean, the sheath wasn't cheap. And the Cerakote alone, I mean, the guy, he did 8 different coatings, so that wasn't cheap. So, but then like I didn't, so they look cool and everything and they really can express yourself with them and they're fun. But that's not really where you're going to end up making your money. And that's where the volume kind of comes in. Even doing some like CNC handle scales and stuff like that, and outsourcing that, where now I could have another guy using his CNC shop to create the scales, and then when they come into me, they're up to my spec, and then all I have to do is bolt them on, and I'm saving like a day of labor on an entire batch of knives, which is huge, because that's how you're actually going to make a profit.
Well, but see, a lot of guys don't think that way.
Yeah.
And we've tried to figure out ways in which we can get scales done outside of the shop. And if you're listening to this, you're wondering what scales are. On a full tang knife, that's the knife where you see the entire silhouette in steel, and then there's two handles bolted together. They're referred to as scales. The problem is what I want, I can't have other people do. Like if I want to do crazy colors, or want to do kind of like composite stuff, or laminations, it just don't work. And I was talking to a CNC guy, a good friend of mine, who'd been on this podcast before, Bree Pettis, and he told me that we crunch numbers in regards to how much it's going to cost and how much time, and the fact that I like the G10 so much and stuff like that. And he says, you're going to have a better price if you on the labor. You're going to have a better price if you do it with the labor. And it's unfortunately it's the case. I give you a lot of credit for having the wherewithal to kind of outsource a lot of that stuff, because a lot of people are unwilling to do it.
Well, I think a lot of people, sometimes they're more in love with the process than they are the actual end product.
Look at
and
you.
That doesn't always transfer. Like, I worked in outdoor shops for fucking years, and the amount of knives I sold in that place, you know how many people asked me the exact type of steel in HRC when I was there?
Zero.
Zero.
Yeah,
you know what they asked? Is this the rusty kind or the not rusty kind?
I'm surprised they even ask you that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Most of the time, like, you know, they don't care. Most of the time, they don't care. And I had a show recently down in Georgia, and I had some of the CNC ones, the fishing ones, and I had some I did by hand. And I'm like, well, which one's done by hand and which one's done by the CNC? And people always got it wrong. So I'm like, you know, and I don't know whether it's good or bad or by quality or not, but it's like, you know, they don't really care that much. At the end of the day, they just need the tool to work. And if I could get my prices down, which is always my goal, because, like, you know, handmade knives are never going to be cheap, but if it's quality, people will spend on it. But also, I don't want to, like, you know, break people's wallets by just, you know, charging too much.
Your prices are on the money. Your prices, I mean, I'm not going to say they're on their money. Your prices are more than fair.
Yeah.
Your prices are more than fair. And, like, you have a lot more. I felt as though you have a lot more experience than a lot of people. Now, I have this theory. I was walking the dogs yesterday, and I spent about a week figuring out what we're going to talk about. And I had this theory, because I was looking at all your pictures of fishing and stuff like that, and I feel like there might be something that we both have in common in terms of this whole thing. What is it about fishing that you love? And this isn't a trick question. I just kind of want to start talking. What is it about fishing and hunting that you love?
It's the memories you make, really. It's never really like that. Obviously, catching a big striper is awesome.
Right.
But I was just at my buddy's baby shower yesterday, whatever that day that was. See, like, I'm bad with these things.
Yeah.
And he was one of those guys that really taught me the way and taught me everything else. And we were scrolling through old photos, and we were just looking at old videos and stuff like that. Me just being a goofball, I have no idea what I'm doing. Being a complete googan out there. And he's the type of guy, that type of friendship that, like, you talk about so much more other than just, like, fishing while you're out there. And you also get to forget about all your life stresses for a while. And, I mean, especially from the job I did, there weren't enough guys that did that. Their stress relief wasn't, like, going out to the woods and being peaceful and slowing down and everything just being quiet. It was, like, going to a bar and drinking beers or something like that with other guys. And it's, like, you know, that's not necessarily the best thing for your health, and it too doesn't really de-stress you that much.
I wonder, because I feel as though years ago I started to do these giant sculptures about fishing lures, and part of me wondered what was it about fishing that I loved, and I love fishing. And part of me came to, after years of having, you know, doing these art shows and trying to figure out what this is all about, I really started to think about what is it about fishing. You know, and I started to realize that to me, fishing was more about the hope and expectation of what's going to happen. And what happens is you're going out, and then you're looking at you're looking at your tackle box, and you're putting together your line, and you're putting everything together, and you're looking at all these lures, and you're looking at all the jigs and all the rubber worms and all that stuff, and you're putting it all together, and you're getting ready for the next day with the expectation of you don't know what's going to happen. And what happens is over time with experience, you start to realize, all right, these are the kind of spots that are good, or large fit, largemouth bass, like, you know, they like the, you know, logs and stuff, and they like this and they like that. And experience kind of teaches you, okay, I remember, you know, when we went walleye fishing, they like these rattle traps, and they like this over here, they like a floating Rapala that is a shallow, whatever. And all of a sudden you start to kind of like, you start to realize, number one, it's hope. You're hoping. You never know what's going to happen. Like, you could get nothing or you could get something. And it's the expectation of you're trying to use your skills and your techniques and throw something out there, and you're kind of hoping it's going to work. And then you amass all these lures, and each lure is different, and from different positions and different colors. And I remember the silver spinners were for bright days, and then the brass spinners were for murky days. And I always just loved, you know, the experience and throwing all these different things out. And a part of me thinks that as knife makers, I feel as though you and I are on the same wavelength in terms of, it's kind of the same thing with knife making, where we're trying different things, and we're trying different colors, and we're trying different styles, and we're trying different techniques, and we're trying to catch a fish.
It's funny that you say that, because the whole time you're saying that, I'm like, yeah, it kind of sounds like running a business.
I mean, am I wrong?
No.
Am I wrong?
Because there's a lot of unknown, but there's also a lot of patterns that you could pick up and follow.
Right.
And too, like, there's so much shit on the internet that you could find out about running a business, trends, sales, what to look into. That's like, when you're not like doom scrolling reels, you could actually use to your advantage. And like, I did the same thing with fishing and hunting, where like, I didn't, obviously my friends showed me the ropes and everything, but like, I did a lot of research on my own to be able to figure out times, places, lore type, everything. And it's the same way with business, where it's like, you start to learn, and like, and also a lot of people put out a ton of free information on podcasts and stuff if you just listen to them.
But but as knife makers, we have a little bit more flexibility in terms of what we can do. Because you have the flexibility of, like, depending on how much you can actually do in your shop, you have the flexibility of saying, making changes and being flexible on the fly.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, there is so much, like, fishing, the connection. And for me, it's been, like, crazy, because my knives have looked like my sculpture forever. And I always think of them the same. And then you make a lot of them. And I used to make these giant sculptures, and I couldn't make one. I couldn't make three. I had to make 50. And then they're all a little bit different, and maybe some will go, and maybe they'll all go, or maybe one will stay, or you never know. And I feel the same way when I make the knives, because I'm just like, why not? Let's give it a try, see what happens.
Well, and sometimes throw it at the wall and see what sticks.
Dude, sometimes throw out a spinner bait on a day that you never know what's going to happen, and then all of a sudden you get the big one. You know, and the best part about fishing is there's hope, and then the more you do it, it's less hope. It's more experience. I had when I was in college, the first sculpture I ever sold to was for a teacher. And he said that he'd give me $200 for this giant sculpture, and I could fish on his property whenever I wanted. So my friends and I were like, this is perfect. We're in Ohio. Ohio's dynamite freshwater fishing. And this pond never got fished before. So they were monster pan fishing there, giant bluegills all the time. And my friends and I would go all the time. If we didn't have class, or even if the bite was good, we would, you know, whatever. And I had this one friend, Mark Myers, who was just like, I don't understand. He knew everything about fishing. He knew he would catch muskies. He would catch walleye. He would send us pictures. He's had boats, and he just understood fishing, and he was a biology major. Now, he's 50. He's my age. He's a professional. He's a professor, but he's also he does the bass fishing tours. He tours all over. Awesome. He does Ranger boats, and he understood it. His experience made the three of us went fishing every time. He always would catch more than us.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter the day.
It's always that guy.
Doesn't matter the time. It doesn't matter the... We could be using the same lures. He always blew our doors off. No question. And if I really do feel like you, the fishing goes from hope to... My experience tells me what's going to happen. And I feel as though with your work, that's the same case. I mean, you're throwing things out and the Cerakote with those flowers on it, and you're trying all these different things. I feel like that connection with the fishing and the knife making is there.
Well, it's just like, you know, you're always trying to look around the next bend.
Right.
And you always, you know, that's, you could stay where you're at and try to pick everything up, or you never know if something's going to be good down the next bend, because I spent a lot of time up on the Delaware River fly fishing up there, and the whole time I was like, yeah, you see a good run and you could spend all the time picking it apart, or you could try a different spot and then who knows, hammer it right away, or have it be nothing. You don't know until you try it.
How good is fly fishing?
Oh, it's great, except for when everybody got locked inside and had days off during the week. That's one of the only perks I loved about the old job, is that I was off during the week and I could go fishing when nobody was out there.
Oh.
But it kind of, actually, that was one of the things that actually kind of pushed me into knife making more, not going to lie, because I have spots everywhere. But I went with one of my coworkers and we were hiking up the Neversink River, and we were in this area that already a lot of people don't go to, and the lot was filled on a Tuesday, and we just looked at each other like, what the fuck? And we're like, all right, we hiked about 2 miles in and didn't even go down a trail. We just like bushwalked down to the river. We're like, all right, there's no way anybody's going to be here. And then lo and behold, after we're like done climbing through all the bushes, there's already two dudes in the water. And we both give each other like the what the hell look. And because they probably did the same exact thing we just did.
Yeah.
Trying to get away from everybody. And then I was like, you know, I do all this fishing and everything to get away from people. And it started turning into the exact opposite. So then I just started working in my garage more. And lo and behold, here I am.
I would imagine you never go to Roscoe, or rarely go to Roscoe.
Not really. I mean, I kind of drive past it all the time. I never really go there. They call it Trout Town, but there's better spots.
Roscoe, New York is considered the trout capital of New York. And a few of my friends and I used to go every year, and we would get a cabin, and we would have a good time. One guy's a restaurateur, one's a designer, another artist, and we would have a great time. And we would, I loved it. And there were parts where you wouldn't find anyone, but then there was one spot that was the best spot of all. We could hike through and not see anybody. The best spot we'd always have was right at a rest stop, right off the Route 6. And it was a 617 or something like that. And it was a rest stop. And
I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. Right before you get into Roscoe proper.
Yep, I've been there.
It's a killer spot. And for some reason, you're just like, no matter how long you try to get away from everybody, do you find this one goddamn spot where right by this rest stop, and you're just like, everyone's there and everyone's killing it.
Yep.
Fishing is the best. I don't do it anymore.
It's, you know, it's funny. I live across the street from a lake and I still barely have time to get out and go fishing.
I don't know. You know what? For me, honestly, some of it's the, I loved it. But part of me is like the cruelty of it all. Ultimately, if you're doing catch and release, if you're eating it, that's one thing. But catch and release, it's just like, for what? Maybe all of a sudden this poor fucking fish has got something in his mouth and he's just like, I don't know. There's something about it. I just was like, I've kind of got off of it. But at the same time, like, I get it. I get it and I love it. And I'd probably go again, and I was obsessed for a long time. I was really like, it was part of like my income was, I was making these giant sculptures that started out. The first one I did was after Rapala in college. And then I started making these monster lures all the time and they just started to evolve. But I'm convinced that there's something, it's that the hunting and fishing is definitely a sense of satisfaction against, you know, you're using your mind and you're using technique, and then you're kind of, you know, tricking for the most part something that doesn't have an opinion or doesn't have, you know, it has instinct and that's it. It doesn't have like, you know, opinions or personalities. It has this, it has instinct, and you're against this thing with like this scientific instinct. And I think that that's where the, and it's your dedication and your ability to outsmart something.
I think it's also the failure. Yeah. I think because you also fail more often than not. I mean, I was just spent the whole weekend hunting, and it was just a lot of sitting in the woods.
Yeah.
And but then it makes the success that much better by having those kind of trials and tribulations. If it was bang up time every time going out there, it wouldn't be the same.
But don't you think that's the same with business?
Well, yeah. And then once you start to figure it out, sure, it goes great. But then you also have to keep figuring it out because things will change. And it's always ever changing with all of this stuff. I mean, there's obviously like books and theories and everything else of what to follow, but you still have to kind of like get the dirt time in and figure it out on your own for what's going to work.
So are you getting a lot of repeat business or?
The majority of my customers are repeat customers, which has been great. And that's always like, it's always a compliment. If somebody's like, you know,
that's right.
they think, oh, well, they must think this knife didn't suck that bad if they're buying another one. And I've got guys that are like, you know, they've within this year alone, they bought like 10 of my knives. And I'm like, what are you doing? And also, what do you do for a living? Can I get that job? Like, if you're just buying 10 of these things.
I used to do that all the time. I would talk to my business partner. I'm like, what is wrong with this guy? Why does he keep buying them? And my partner would be like, oh, obviously, he has no idea what he's talking about. The repeat customer really is something that is remarkable. Because ultimately, a knife is not, you know, an iron lung. You know, it's not something that you really truly need. So like the culinary knife game is great because, you know, obviously you have more, your demographic is larger, way larger. But the interesting thing is when people buy a knife, they don't, as much as we talk about it on Knife Talk or talk with other knife makers, they buy the knife, they use the knife, and they don't think about the knife. No one's really spending time and energy thinking about not only their object, but the person that made it. So somebody might just buy your knife. Maybe they won't even use it. Or maybe they will use it or just don't even think about it. But one of the things I know that you get, and I think it probably it drives you, it makes you nervous, is when you send a knife out and you don't hear a thing.
Nothing.
That's nervous making, right?
Yeah, especially when it's like a massive order that you just did and you're like, do you even like the thing? Are we good?
Did you get it?
Yeah, sometimes it's, and you know, people, they get the knife though. And I think too, at times, like we have to remember, like we're not as important to them as we may think.
No.
And I think that's where a lot of people go wrong with selling shit too, is that they're thinking more about me and my design and what I did. And it's like, it's just a trick for everybody. Your customer doesn't give a shit. They're thinking about themselves and what they're going to do with the thing. So they get it, and then they want to see what they're going to be doing with it. Even with selling it to them, it's like, I try to remind, like, all the marketing and everything is what you're going to do with the thing, not how this is the best thing I've ever created.
But it's also the idea between artist, craftsman, business person.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of times we fall for years on Knife Talk, and this was a simple thing. I didn't really do much of it. All I wanted to say was I was trying to be controversial without being that controversial. And I basically had met somebody I was at Blade Show years ago, and I introduced myself and I said, "Oh yeah, I'm Jeff Fader, and my business is Fader Knives." And this guy goes, "Oh, my name is so and so. I'm a knife artist." And I was like, a knife artist? What the fuck is, I said, because the funny thing is there are sculptors who use tools. And they use tools as their sculptures. There's this sculptor, his name is Armand, and he's very famous for welding thousands of axes together. So you could say he's an axe artist. So when the guy says to me, I'm a knife artist, I'm thinking, boy's taking a pile of Wusthofs and just welding them all together.
making an iron throne.
Yeah, making a sculpture with a fucking knife. So that's what I think of. And then all of a sudden you meet all these people that they think that they're artists and they say that they're artists. And I've gotten to the point now where you call yourself whatever you want. But the problem is when you start to think of yourself that way from a subconscious level, you're putting yourself at a different level or tier than someone who is a craftsperson or a business person. And then you start to automatically think of yourself more, and you get into kind of diva land. You get into diva land, and like what we were talking about in the beginning of, you're not, well, I don't do those things. I don't do those things. And I'm guilty of that. I have traumas of when I was a kid, my dad was a winemaker and he used to do farmers markets and I hated them. I had to do them with them because the people, when you're giving wine samples away at a farmer's market, what do you think majority of people are just trying to do?
Yeah, they're just trying to get drunk.
Get bombed. So on your it's dollar. Like, they don't give a they don't give a shit about the tasting notes. Trust me. They don't give a fuck about you and your winery. They're just wanting to give you a little bit more sample. So I hated it. I hated the asked questions. I hated everything about it. And it makes me like not want to do events, which is, and I think a lot of other people feel the same way. That's just like, I don't want to set up a booth. I don't want to stand around asking the same questions, and I don't want to do it. And a lot of people are unwilling to do it. And what I give you a lot of credit for is you just got back from Georgia. Yeah. Tell me about, you were at a Georgia Bushcraft event?
Georgia Bushcraft, yep.
What was that like?
So that was fun. And it was actually two events in one. So there's a group called the Campfire Co-op, which is a bunch of different outdoor industry businesses that actually meet up together and talk, and like they help each other out. And, you know, they're just talking about strategies, business, marketing, you know, and other bullshit that goes along with running a business. And it's just where a group where like-minded people in the industries can actually share ideas and help each other out. Because at the end of the day, like, you know, yes, there was like, you know, even at this event, Georgia Bushcraft, I think there was like maybe like 13 or 14 other knife makers. And some people would view that as competition, but it's like, we're all different.
Right.
And the more of us here is the more interest that's going to come to this kind of thing. And just the networking ability is huge at these kind of things. So,
go ahead.
It was, the first half was just the meetings and everything. And then the second half was the Georgia Bushcraft event itself, where I had the booth, we were selling knives, we had them out there on display and everything. And then there was also events, classes, and things. Everybody camped there for the entire weekend. It's a fun time. It was cold as hell, though.
Did you get a good time?
Oh, it was great. And even, it's just like, we didn't like kill it with sales, but that wasn't my intention. Because, I mean, I joke around with this all the time, and like, I'll still stand by the statement that bushcrafters don't really spend money, because your hobby is to go out in the woods with as minimal amount of equipment as you have and make it happen. Bro. So I always catch flack for that one, but it's true. Like, you guys, you know, it's meant to be cheap.
Don't listen. I got a funny story. When I started getting into this knife game, I started to meet guys who were like, they're making these choppers and these, they, when I'm out in the woods, I only use this and that and the other thing. And I wanted it. All I wanted to say to him is, cause my dad, I had a vineyard. So we were doing a lot of stuff out in the fields and the woods, and we were, you know, cutting down trees and shit like that. And all I could think of is, if you're going out on a job, let's say you're a park ranger and they're telling you they need you to clear out, you know, 3/4 of a mile for a new part of the, you know, let's just say the Appalachian Trail needs a clearing out, are you going to go out with a fucking knife?
No.
No, you're gonna go out with a chainsaw,
fucking, or you're gonna go out
with power tools. You're gonna go out with the stuff. And I started to make jokes about it because it's just like, these guys are chopping down trees. They're going, nobody in their right mind, no park ranger is gonna be like, all I need is this competition chopper. That's all I need. No, it's not. And it's the same thing with the fucking lighting of the, you know, like, I love all these, you know, bushcrafters, but at the same time, I'm just like, if you're really, really in a situation where you just need this flint and this knife, I think you're in big trouble. You're not going out. You're bringing a lighter with you. I'm promising you. But it's always funny to me, for the knife makers in general, it's like some of the gymnastics we go through in order to say how we live our lives is hilarious. Totally hilarious.
Well, at times I feel like it's a lot of cosplaying.
Of course.
You're like, LARPing. Come on.
You're 100% really, right.
I had a couple 100%. Guys come up to the table and they would look at that like Hawaiian one I did, and they would have like a 7-inch blade, like bushcraft right. knife on them. They're like, I wouldn't use that thing ever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, how often do you use this thing other than at this event yeah. where you're carrying around, like, you know, because like also like at that event, I could throw a rock and hit a giant bushcraft knife. We weren't in a survival situation. Like,
yeah. hilarious. Well, it's hilarious.
They're all trying to play the part, and I get it. But at times, too, it's like, I like to be practical with almost everything.
Right.
And even, like, it was, like, 22 degrees down there one morning, which is not normal for Georgia.
No.
And a couple of the guys at the tent across from me, they were busting my balls because I brought a propane torch to light my fireplace. And they're like, oh, well, that's not very bushcraft of you. I'm like, I don't care. Lighter goes,
yeah.
And I have a fire. And the next morning when it was 22 degrees and I'm already making my coffee, and I see the guy with his little Bic lighter, and he's trying to get his fire going, and I see him looking over at me. I'm like, come on, bud, you can come over here. You can take the torch. I won't tell anyone. And now I'm telling everybody on the podcast. But it's like, yeah, come on, cheat a little bit. It's fine. You don't need to prove yourself to me right now.
That's one of the things with knife making that's just so exhausting. This is this concept of there's a virtue. There's this virtue of the way you do things. And it might be in bushcraft too. I remember I made a knife, and I put bushcraft in the hashtag or something like that. And the guy goes, this is not a bushcraft knife because it's got a knuckle guard. These are fighting knives. Knuckle guards are fighting knives. And I was just like,
sure.
My man, this is, you know, I'm with you. And I was just like, I'm with you. I don't fight for free. I don't fight for free on the internet. You got to pay me to fight. So, but at the same time,
people want to listen to anyway, because I bet you, I can almost guarantee you the guy never fucking does anything.
Well, this is also the problem with the culinary game too, is we're coming up with these gymnastics in order to have a degree of valiance. Valiance is really the right word. And it's this fake, and it isn't as much as it was maybe six or seven years ago. There was a lot more people, knife makers, who were puffing out their chest in regards to what's correct and what's not correct. And a part of me feels like social media is kind of weeding a lot of these old kind of pains in the asses out. But at the same time, times are definitely changing in regards to that. But I remember people just throwing themselves around about, if you're using jigs to make your knives, you're not a knife maker. Or if you're not forging your knives, you're not a knife maker. Or if you're not doing a fat satin finish and you're doing these belt finishes, you're not a knife maker. And there were these, and if you're taking deposits, you're not a knife. And there were all these, like, there were all these things of valiance that were just completely for a community, not for a community that, like you said, like the bushcrafters, they don't pay anything. But it's the same thing with the knife makers. I mean, it's like, you're not buying knives anyway. So it's like, what the fuck do you care?
Well, I had a guy at one of the shows I did recently, not the Georgia one, but it was another show up in Jersey. He was like looking at one of the knives and he's like, well, did you forge it? And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I had a machine water jet cut it, and then I did all the rest of the work. And now at this point, too, I bring a blank with me for when people want to be assholes and be like, well, you didn't really make it. And I hand it to them, say, you turned this into that.
Well, I'll tell you how the hilarious part is. Anybody who asks that question, they already know. If they don't know and they're really asking you the question, they don't know what forging looks like anyway. That's the real issue is most of these people are looking for words to say that show their degree of whatever expertise at whatever level they are. But most knife makers, you know, look, if you want to forge, forge. If you don't want to forge, don't forge. Most of these customers don't give a shit either way, but they want to create some type of, I don't know, pecking order in regards to, like I said, valiance.
Yeah, but they're not your customer, because even this guy, he wasn't going to buy it anyway. And two, I'm like, all right, so say I magically forge this thing. I'm going to slap another $400 on that price tag. You cool with that? And he's like, well, no. And I'm like, all right, so then why are you busting my balls about it? You can't even afford it now. And it's stock removal.
I was at this makers event years ago with my friends, and we were doing a lot of demos. This guy just like starts looking at me and he goes, and he looked like he was asking these questions as if he was like, you know, like a master bladesmith or something like that. And he goes, what's the metal that you're using? And that's a red flag. Those words right there are a red flag. You don't know what he's talking about. Like, there are certain words that people say, they just don't know what they're talking about. And the weirdest part is this concept between stock removal and forging and whether one is more valuable than the other. It's so irrelevant, but we've created this concept, and part of it's forge and fire, and part of it's from, I blame Knife Talk, frankly. A Knife Talk has been a bastion of giving people certain opinions in regards to what's, you know, more important than others. The most interesting part about knife making is that the two guys who really crossed, who changed, if it wasn't for Bob Loveless, who was a stock removal purist. Stock removal purist. If it wasn't for Bob Lovelace, the ABS, and he did not forge, and he used powdered metal, steel, super steels, and all that bullshit. If it wasn't for him, the ABS probably wouldn't exist. That's, the ABS is like a, and I'm, you could, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I, based on the conversations I had with Laren Thomas, the ABS really started from, oh God, Bill Moran. Bill Moran started it as a result of, all right, everyone's going to be doing the stock removal shit. We got to make sure people are forging. So if it wasn't for the stock removal guys, the greatness of the ABS and forging probably would be buried and dead.
Well, competition is always healthy anyway. Competition is always what's going to bring out new and better ideas. Whether or not they're held in any kind of merit is a different story. Because, you know, you hear some of the old stories about how Damascus is now a super steel because I have nowhere from forging, it just got better, which it always like cracks me up when people will look at like a Damascus knife and think it's like, so, you know, straight from the heavens.
Right.
And then when you look at 1084, just in bar stock, you're like, oh, that's a cheap steel. And you're like, do you know what's used in most of these Damascus knives that you are calling amazing godly steels? It's all the same stuff.
Everybody wants to feel like they know what they're talking about. And even knife makers. I mean, my experience as a blacksmith is we're coming up on, you know, we're coming up on 15 years of forging. The forging that I see from a lot of knife makers is nothing to write home, but nobody should be too impressed with it anyway. So it's like, it's just like everyone needs to kind of relax a little bit in regards to stock removal versus forging. And it's unnecessary. It's an unnecessary flex. What makes me wonder is who would you see as influences on your work?
So I would say definitely a guy like Wegner Blades. He's more of a field knife maker, outdoor knife maker. His designs are very clean, crisp, very utilitarian. And another one would, and it's even like a guy who I'd probably want to like model my business off of is, do you know LT Wright Knives?
They're
very big in the bushcraft world. And he started years ago and he started a shop underneath the staircase in his house. And now he's like, you know, one of the big names in the bushcraft knife land. And I mean, even at this last show I was at, like, I got to meet him. I'm actually looking at one of their knives that I got on a trade, which is like now, like, it's one of those ones I'm definitely going to cherish because he started from the ground up and does all by hand. Now has like 8 employees in his shop out there.
Wow.
And they turn out numbers, like big numbers of knives with dealers and everything else. And they invited me to their shop to do a tour, which was, you know, here I am, like, always looking up to this guy, and also me being me, like, I've done a lot of research of figuring out how he came up, you know, his business plans, everything else, like, and then here he is saying, hey, come on in, we'll show you how the sausage is made. And I was, like, kind of taken away by that, because that's a guy that I've always looked up to for just knife design and also how to run a business.
It's got to feel pretty good, like you're on the right track.
Well, it's weird when these people like, and that's also a good thing about me going to these shows at times, because like, I don't know, we're all very isolated in our own world, especially living through phones all the damn time. And then too, like, you know, even the previous job, I did everything I could to go unrecognized. So now it's kind of weird having people actually recognize me, and I don't know how I feel about it yet.
Well, you have to. I mean, that's part of the game. You know,
well,
you
gotta,
and you do a very good, P.S., you do a very good job. You don't stutter, you don't stammer, you're very quick to the point. You don't, there's no fat when you talk. So you're not doing what I'm doing with all this bullshit. There's no fat. You're really very, very good at selling your knives. If that means anything.
Straight to the meat and potatoes.
But, yeah, no, you're good at it. You're really good at like, there's no extraneous words.
Well, people, you know, especially that's just from me studying what works. And it's like, I don't know. A lot of times people think that there's not that much goes into this, but like all day long, I'm looking into this when I'm not working like physically. I guess it's like working on the business or working for the business or whatever the hell they break that down as. Like, I'm always trying to research new things. And even if it's in like different realms, like I'll listen to guys like Jimmy DiResta talk all the time on their podcast. And it's like, I'm not doing anything close to what they're doing. But when you listen to like Hooks and getting people engaged and everything else, like there's a little bit of everything you can learn. And like, also too, like you learn, like you're trying to tell a story every time you're doing these posts. People want to get interested if they're going to stay along with it, or just get the information out there fast because, you know, they're going to be scrolling on to the next thing in no time.
Well, I just feel as though you haven't been doing it very long and the way you're going about everything is awesome. Like I'm very impressed by everything you've been doing. It's really been like fun. And it was really fun to meet you at Maker Camp, and I'm really like, you're a very impressive young man, and it's really cool seeing what you're doing.
Well, we'll hope it keeps on going.
Well, you hope, you know, don't go home with hope.
I mean, ain't that just like fishing?
Hope is for the birds. Never hope is the worst. That is the one thing I hate. Hope. I feel like good luck sucks. I think you got everything is your, it's you and your responsibility. It has nothing to do with, you have to do whatever it takes. You have to take complete responsibility for everything. That's my own problem. And you know, everything is my fault. I believe everything I do right or wrong is my fault. And it's like, I don't believe in hope or luck. I got to make my own.
It's tough because sometimes you end up beating yourself up, though, because that's something I do way too often. Yeah, I mean, it's like you try to take responsibility for everything, but at times you're like, oh, man, you're being, I don't know, I'm very hard on myself. That's just me.
I know, and I hope that you just kind of like learn to not be as hard on yourself, because I think that one of the things I remember is when I had my partnership and my partners, and I would get these emails saying, we just wanted to know how things are going, and I would ultimately always think that they were being like, hurry up, what are you doing? But my business partner told me, no, they're just excited. You have to stop with the worrying of people mad at you or anything like that. And it's hard. And once again, it's all experience. Experience kind of like teaches you to, you know, not be so hard on yourself. And I hope that, you know, I hope that you're not that hard on yourself, right?
Well, it's trying to learn this whole like work-life balance thing. It's kind of still very difficult.
Well, you've only been doing it for like a couple of years. You're not allowed to have work-life balance. Yeah, you gotta what you gotta be doing for now. I mean, that's the hard part. I was listening to I love sports radio because it's the only really great live broadcasting these days. And I was listening to these two guys, and they were talking about their, you know, how they got to where they got. And one guy he just wanted to be a broadcaster, and he just worked. And then he got a job, and he was getting coffee, and he was just determined. And then he got fired, and then he had to go back to like the minor leagues, and then he went back, and then he did overnights, and he was unrelenting, and it probably was tough on his relationship with his wife and everything. But now he's got this great show, and he's really, really good at what he does. But it's some people, you gotta grind and you gotta just put your nose down, and that's just the way it is. It's everything doesn't come easy. And I can tell when I see all your work and I see you looked at your website's awesome and all the different knives you have, the different operations and the different things you do. I know how hard you work, and I appreciate how hard you're working.
No, it does mean the world, because sometimes, like I said, we're all in our bubble and you never know if you're really doing the right thing or not.
I want to know if you're ever going to do like a old school survival knife. No one's doing like a Rambo knife where there's a little carp, but there's a little pocket with a fishing rod, a fishing reel.
Yeah, there is a guy, and you should look into him. The Wilson Custom Knives. He also has his tech line. He's making them, but they actually work, unlike the old Rambo ones that they fall apart and everything. He's a good guy. I think he's based out of Oregon, but like same thing.
What's
his
name?
Has a compass and everything. Wilson Custom Knives. Right. And he has his Tech Line series too, which is his like OEM ones that he's machining out. And then he has his handmade ones where like I saw him at Blade Show, and like you can't miss this guy. He's wearing like the loudest purple and pink Hawaiian shirt, and has a big cowboy hat on, and like a mustache that goes pretty much ear to ear on him.
And is this Craig Wilson or Jacob Wilson?
I think it's Craig.
Okay. CKK. Okay.
But, and he had the classic, like, giant Rambo knife, serrations, everything else on it. and you're just looking at this thing and just made you feel like a kid again. Yeah, it's Wilson underscore custom underscore knives.
Wilson, this is great radio.
Yeah, it sure is. But like, it's literally everything you're describing, like with the old junk, like $15 gas station knife. But actually, like, he batons with it, he beats it up, he carves, and he's headed. I mean, one of the guys from the survival training company down in Georgia, one of the instructors, just took it to the jungle with him as his jungle knife and used it for all of his tasks down there. So it's like,
give me this guy's name again. Wilson underscore what?
Underscore custom underscore knives. Wilson, you're going to have to pay me for this kind of plug now after this.
Does he even listen to this?
But yeah, it's Sam Wilson. He's the man. And his, like, it's, okay, but that's kind of stuff like that too, where you're like, you're almost wondering, like, how many people are really buying these things? But it's got to be enough, because this is his full time job, is making these things.
Oh, shit. They look cool.
Yeah. They're, and like, you know, of course, everybody who gets it has to load it up, like the fishing line and everything else. Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's a lot of the stuff that you're using it for is kind of like tchotchke stuff anyway. You're never really going to be using that stuff.
Oh, no, of course not.
That's what, like, I talk about.
Oh, yeah, there he is with that fucking Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's better than his sign that he has at Blade Show, because you just see the shirt. It's almost like glowing across the room.
These guys are too funny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you got to do. You're doing a Rambo knife and stuff like that. You got to, like, make it seem like you're not as much. That's awesome. Well, yeah, I think that stuff is hilarious.
But I actually am working on a couple bigger knives, because right now it's been all small stuff. And, but like the big stuff, it's, I don't know, like I've tested all my knives and I do a lot of dirt time on all of them before they go out the door. Cause I don't want to, especially in some of the stuff that I'm making, like if a guy's using it on the job or if a guy's going out to the woods with the thing for a while, like you don't want the thing to be not perform.
Right.
So one of the bigger knives I've been working on, I actually tested on it all last winter. Cause in the shop, I heat it with wood, just like we do the house. So I'm like breaking down wood with this thing every day for like 4 or 5 months. And I actually broke it. Not on the blade, but I broke the standoffs in the handle from batoning it so much. Now, is somebody really going to be taking this knife and batoning it every day, all the time? I mean, maybe I did. So it's got to be up to snuff for like that kind of stuff. So, and actually, that was the nice part about doing the Georgia Bushcraft Show, is like I brought the prototype that I've been working on. And I was able to just pass it around with people that I actually trust and they know what they're doing and get real feedback on it.
What's next? What's next? Man. For Tom Nugent, Knives by Nuge, what's next?
Just going to try to keep cruising. We're trying to really get more of these pursuit-based lines out there a bit more between the hunting series, the fishing series, the camping primitive series. We're trying to really get that to stick. And I mean, it has been so far. It's been very well received by the customer base. And then who knows? I've been playing with some new handle designs and everything. I've been trying to, like, you know, change it up a bit. KH Daly, he was a big help with me doing a couple of handles, like
Kyle, like
Coke bottle. Yeah, that he's the man. And I remember you talking about like influence versus inspired. And I was definitely heavily influenced with this last one that I did, to the point where he sent me the picture of the smaller one that he does. And I'm like, holy shit, I even made it look the same. Oops. Sorry,
that's
Kyle.
Okay. Don't worry about Kyle. He'll be all right.
Yeah. And it's funny, cause he even sent me the piece of my card and he's like, think you could do something with this. And normally I'm doing slabs and stuff. I'm like, well, let me try what he does with this Coke bottle and everything. But I ended up using the same goddamn neon pins and liner like he used on his one. I'm like, wow, that was a little subconscious influencing right there.
There you go.
But trying to do more of the custom work while also maybe one day doing more of a production line. Because like I said, like I want to get these, they're tools that I'm making. I'm not making art pieces. I want people to use them and to feel comfortable using them. And not everybody's going to go beat the crap out of a $300 knife. So I'm trying to get the price down even lower, whether that's like a mid-tech line. But, you know, that's all in the future. We'll see what happens.
More blue blades, please.
Oh, my God. More of the blue ones. So I get I got people on the internet mad about that one.
Why?
Well, because blue is for trainers. So
gives a shit. Then don't buy it. Well, I love those blue blades.
I tell everybody all the time, if you don't like it, just don't buy it. And also, like, they're busting my balls about it being like a fighting knife. I'm like, I designed this for fishing. Like, that's what are you worried about on the river?
I had no idea. I had no idea that that's a training knife. All right, well, there you go.
Well, it's not. It's just that that's, you know, like you said earlier, it's people who know a little bit about something trying to, like, explain to you why they know more than you. And I'm like, bro, like, I've handled trainers. I've worked with this. Like, I do all the fighting with my buddies at jiu-jitsu and everything, too, where we'll put on gloves and we'll bring, like, trainers and stuff. Like, I know how this whole violence thing works. You don't have to explain it to me. But this is a fishing knife, so relax a little bit.
Tom Nugent. Knives by Nuge, ladies and germs. Go follow Knives by Nuge on Instagram. Give this guy support. He's an awesome dude. I'm really, like, I love watching what you're doing, and I'm really, like, I'm into it, man. I'm on board with Tom Nuge. I'm all on board with Tom Nugent, Knives by Nuge.
Oh, I appreciate the support, and like I said, I wouldn't be able to do any of this without, like, your podcast, Knife Talk, even Full Blast. It's kind of weird being on this, the amount of times I've listened to your podcast and now doing this thing.
Well, it wasn't that bad, was it?
No, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good afterwards. Is it feeling mutual?
Feeling's great. Glad you're here. I knew it was going to be good. I knew where we were going to go. And I'm really happy you're here. And look, I'm a huge supporter of you. And anything you need from me, let me know.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it as always.
Guys, you heard what I had to say. Go follow Knives by Nuge on Instagram. Go support this guy. He's doing a good thing. And we will see you next week. And if you're listening to this and it's Friday, Saturday is the Damage Steel DCI Invitational. And you want to watch Knife Talk live, that's where you go. Go to damagesteel.se to register for free. Okay, guys, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.